5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey everybody, welcome back. I am so glad you guys enjoyed listening to Dan Zetterstrom's podcast, What It Means to Be Human. A bunch of you reached out to me, some of you reached out to him, which is even better. Go find his podcast on whatever platform you like. Follow him, talk to him. He's so excited because now he's communicating with you guys. But we're going to be talking to him. We're going to have him on the show. We'll ask him about the podcast, about his experience as a UFO hunter and researcher, all of his sort of paranormal background. But what's really fun about Dan is it seems like as soon as we have an episode of the show, he has some weird experience connected to whatever it is we're talking about. I mentioned last week that he went to visit Michael Chapman, the spirit healer, and actually had great results. But even weirder is that he told me that he's been doing EMDR, which plays a huge role in induced after-death communication, which was the book we covered just a couple episodes ago. So he's going to tell the story of actually having an induced after-death communication with his dog who passed away. Now, I haven't heard the story yet, so you'll hear it the same time I hear it. I'm really excited. So we'll all be looking forward to that. That's going to come up in a few weeks. So keep an eye out for that. I think that's all the news I've got. Oh, no. We're still doing the sale on all the merch. Okay. Go to the website, richardhaddamsparanormalbookshelf.com. Click on shop exclusive merch in the top right-hand corner. And you're going to get everything for 26% off for 2026. Just enter the promo code RHPB26. Everything's available now. You can get the glasses, the pint glasses, the hoodies, the t-shirts, the tote bags, the socks, anything you need. Now's the time to get it. So jump in there. You deserve it. All right, here we go. Sasquatch by Don Hunter and Renee DeHinden. Sasquatch, McClelland and Stewart, Ontario, 1973, is one of the least paranormal books on my paranormal bookshelf. It is filled with mystery and wonder, but it is of the buried treasure kind, the D.B. Cooper kind, or Amelia Earhart. It is a book about men searching for something in the woods and in their hearts. They absolutely expect to find it, photograph it, capture it, or if need be, kill it. Written by the perfectly named Don Hunter, it's actually about Don's co-author, Renee DeHinden, and his quest to be the man, to prove to the world that Sasquatch actually exists. I picture him in cartoon form, holding two electrical cords in either hand, one marked legend and one marked science, and struggling mightily to bring them together and make the connection and have the word Sasquatch light up in blazing red neon over his head. For purposes of clarity, when I say Sasquatch, I'm talking about Bigfoot. The terms are used somewhat interchangeably in the book, But because the book is a Canadian publication, and Sasquatch is how the First Nations people of British Columbia referred to the creature, Sasquatch gets title billing. Bigfoot is the name he uses when he crosses the border into the United States. Whatever you call him, though, according to this book, he's out there, right now, eating berries or pooping in a lake, but he's physically there, acting like an animal, just waiting for some dude to capture him on film or in a large butterfly net. Or kill him. It feels like a million dudes have tried, but so far the score is Bigfoot a million, dudes zero. And to be honest, I'm okay with that. I don't know if Bigfoot is flesh and blood or something else, but I'm okay with him being out there, just beyond our reach. It was the last week of summer before sixth grade, and I couldn't wait for school to start. The last 3 months had been unusually dull and uneventful. At least at school, there was the possibility of something interesting happening. A week later, school finally started, and guess what? Something interesting happened. In fact, it was beyond interesting. It was life-changing. I was sitting in the back seat of Mrs. Valentino's car. Mrs. Valentino was a friend of my mom's from down the street, and they took turns doing school pickups that year. David Valentino was sitting up front in the passenger seat. Right now, it was just the two of us. Mrs. Valentino had gotten out to drop something off at the school office. David was in eighth grade, but seemed way older. He was a very cool kid. A surfer type, and a surfer in real life. He had long, wavy blonde hair, and he wore tan cords, an OP shirt, a puka shell choker, and Vans. He had always been nice to me, but I knew he was a bad kid and had gotten into fights, so I was provisionally afraid of him. But for some reason, I also considered him a possible ally if I ever got into any kind of real trouble. I would never have had the courage to ask him for help of any kind, but in my imagination, if he ever saw me being bullied by someone in my grade, I thought he might intervene, if for no other reason than to have the opportunity to beat up a younger kid. "Who's that?" he said. I looked where he was looking and saw a girl in my grade walking down the steps. "I don't know," I said. "I think she's new." He caught my eyes in the rearview mirror and smiled a lizardy smile. "When she's in eighth grade, she's gonna be fine." He said fine all drawn out. Fine. I knew what fine meant. It meant Foxy. I looked back at her, and a lizardy part of my brain tried to see what he was seeing. And then I saw it. And then I went through puberty. I mean, right then and there, in the backseat of Mrs. Valentino's car. Did it happen for you like that? One day you saw something, a TV commercial, an album cover, a picture in a magazine, and boom, you knew the secret. You knew who you were, and what you were, and why you were placed upon the earth. It was just like that, like a switch being flipped. No ramp up, just off, then on. Something clicked into focus. How could I not have seen it before? I found out soon enough that the girl's name was Gina Gillen. She was in none of my classes, and maybe that was for the best, because now, every time I saw her, it was like catching a glimpse of a ghost or a UFO or Bigfoot. An impossible thing that somehow also existed in my normal life. I couldn't stop thinking about her. I mean, I literally never stopped thinking about her. I found a small notebook, one my mother wasn't using, and I began to keep a journal, a Gina journal. I would keep meticulous notes writing down when I saw her and what the exact time was and what the exact surrounding circumstances were. I don't know why I did this. It just seemed important. At first, it was enough that she just existed. Just knowing that someone like her could exist made every other thing in my life endurable. I forgave everything, every boring moment, Every meaningless day, every tedious hour was easier to bear because I knew that one day Gina Gillen would be in the eighth grade and she would be fine. It was a secret given to me by David Valentino. I was the only one who knew, but it was better than that. To me, she was fire magic. She was already fine. Did anyone else know that she was fine? Did she know she was fine? Wasn't sure. I began to get a little edgy and possessive. I knew she was fine right now. Was there any way to position myself in her life so that when she and the rest of the world realized she was fine, I would be the one that she would, what, be fine with? I wasn't sure. Something was happening. Something brand new. I felt like I know something. I know a secret. It's about Gina Gillen, and it makes me feel like life is worth living. I suppose I should make it clear that there really was nothing sexual in these feelings, at least not in any way that I could understand. Not yet. I didn't fantasize about kissing her or even holding her hand. In sixth grade, my mind and body had not quite fallen into lockstep as far as girls were concerned. But those two roads were obviously veering dangerously close together. And all of this was happening long before I discovered masturbation, which didn't happen until the end of the following summer, thanks to the Oster Infrared Heat Vibra Massage Massager that I found on the top shelf of our hall closet. And by the way, it was actually called that. You can look it up. An infrared heat vibra massage massager. What did that even mean? And how did I know to put it right on my penis? The point I'm making is that at the time I was feeling them, I didn't have any context for the feelings I was having about Gina, and no obvious direction or outlet for them either. So what did I do with those feelings? I enjoyed them. They didn't scare me. Not yet. These feelings made me happy. They soothed me. I didn't need to have her or possess her. Kind of like Bigfoot. Just knowing she was out there was enough. Sasquatch, the book, was written in the 1970s, and the 1970s were prime flesh and blood Bigfoot days. There's no mention of portals in this book, or thin spots, or Bigfoot climbing into or out of a UFO. No high strangeness, no ghost Bigfoot theories of any kind. Now, this is the biggest difference between discussions of Bigfoot then and now. If, in 1973, you had asked Don Hunter or Rene DeHinden if the mystery of Bigfoot would be solved by 2025, they would have laughed and said, absolutely. Well, it hasn't been solved. And it is this very fact that has led some researchers, like Joshua Cutchin and Timothy Renner, to theorize that Bigfoot may not be as fleshy and bloody as we once thought. In fact, Cutchin and Renner have co-written a 2-volume book on that very subject called Where the Footprints End: High Strangeness and the Bigfoot Phenomenon. Copyright Cutchin and Renner, 2020. I think the thing that separates the flesh and blood Bigfooters from the ghost Bigfooters is the active expectation that the mystery will be solved, and soon, any day now, in fact. Because when something physically exists in the real world, it's nothing more than a matter of time before you're holding it in your hands. Rene DeHinden was born in Switzerland and from all accounts was a wanderer and an adventurer long before he ever even heard of Sasquatch. It was in his nature. He met Wanja, the love of his life, in Stockholm, Sweden. They married and she traveled with him to Canada as he searched for work and adventure. In retrospect, it's clear she had no idea what she was getting into. On December 3rd, 1953, at the age of 23, Rene DeHinden was in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, listening to the radio news. A story came out of London, England, announcing the formation of a British expedition to search for something called the Yeti in the Himalayan mountains of Asia. Up until that moment, he had never heard of this strange creature, but something about it captured his imagination. He remarked to his friend Wilbur Willick, "Now wouldn't that be something to be on the hunt for that thing?" To which Willick replied, "Hell, you don't even have to go that far. They got them things right here in British Columbia." That's my Canadian accent. Work with me. As Rene confirmed in later interviews, "Something clicked inside me that day, and looking back, it seemed that maybe I'd been searching all my life for a chance like this, a chance to really accomplish something." I've always believed that one's deepest paranormal obsessions are at least partly aesthetic. If you're drawn to historical buildings, homes, and castles, you're probably a ghost person. If you're fascinated by astronomy, the heavens, the glory of the night sky, with a side dish of technology, maybe UFOs are your thing. And if you love the woods, forests, camping, and the outdoors, you're quite likely a Bigfoot person. I had learned the word aesthetics the previous year in fifth grade from our homeroom teacher, Mrs. Ritter. Mrs. Ritter was beautiful, but in an exotic and sophisticated way. She wasn't from these parts. She was from San Francisco. She dressed for work like she was going to work in the couture section of Bullock's or Buffum's or some other high-end department store. Unlike almost all the other teachers at Brightwood, she didn't look or act like a mom. She was something else, an artist. And so our curriculum skewed toward that. History, English, and social science lessons were all presented to us visually and usually with some connection to an artist's interpretation of whatever idea or concept we were discussing. At some point, she used the word aesthetics, which I found fascinating because I didn't understand it and couldn't pronounce it. Mrs. Ritter defined it as, quote, "any individual's idea or concept of what is beautiful," which may or may not be spot on, but is forever the way I'll think of it, because there was room for me in that definition. My feelings counted. In fact, they were crucial. She was encouraging us to explore what we personally found beautiful in art. You don't have to love the Mona Lisa or Van Gogh's Starry Night just because they're famous. You're allowed to have your own opinion, and that extended to everything in the world. If I was more interested in reading about Bigfoot than I was in playing kickball, that was okay because that was just my aesthetic. It didn't make me bad or weird. It just made me me. Sure, I knew it didn't change anyone else's opinion of me, but it helped me improve my opinion of myself, if only slightly. Throughout the fall of my sixth grade year, my aesthetic world exploded with the addition of Gina Gillen. After school, when I was at home, I would try to imagine what she was doing. Homework? Listening to the radio? Was she eating dinner with her family? Did she have a family? Did she have siblings? Did she live in a house? Or did she just ascend to heaven each time she left my sight? These questions slowly took on a more practical aspect. I was already writing down every time I saw her in my little notebook. Maybe I should be trying to compose a more complete portrait of who or what she was. We didn't share any classes, and we didn't have any mutual friends. But if you kept your eyes and ears open, you could learn things. Over the course of weeks from my personal investigation, I discovered several facts. Her closest friends seemed to be Melody, Jessica, and maybe Alice. And after school, she went home on the bus rather than getting picked up. And that didn't narrow things down much in terms of knowing where she lived. But one day in early November, I made a big leap forward in my gathering of intel. the permission slips for a field trip to the Museum of Natural History were due, and they all got turned in to Mrs. Liu. One day, as I walked into Mrs. Liu's classroom, I saw them all sitting there on her desk. Class hadn't started yet, and the room was in chaos. Mrs. Liu was talking to some girls and getting them to rearrange all the desks into four-person pods for some reason. So in a burst of inspiration, I picked up the permission slips, and my lie if I got caught was that I was just making sure mine was in there. And I went through them, and I found Gina's pretty quick, and I learned that she lived on Ridgecrest, which was a street just above mine. The street was huge and went on for miles, but hey, at least it was something. Now I knew she lived in a house and had at least one parent. I also knew her address, but it meant nothing to me. I couldn't easily walk the length of her street. At 10, I wasn't really allowed to go out unsupervised, so what was I going to do? Beg my brother to go with me to go find a house on Ridgecrest for some reason? A few weeks later, with my mom, we were in our station wagon, and we were heading back from the Alpha Beta supermarket, and she had to drop off some styrofoam cups at Mrs. Tanaka's house because Mrs. Tanaka was doing refreshments for the PTA meeting next month, and I suddenly realized we were driving up Ridgecrest. So I quickly began scanning addresses, and although I didn't actually see her house because my mom was driving too fast, I did manage to narrow Gina down to a single block. Good. Getting closer. I wrote it all down in my notebook. What was wrong with me? Nothing, really. I was just 10 years old and obsessed with the idea of a person for reasons I didn't understand. All I knew was I felt better when I thought about Gina Gillen, and my day snapped into focus and became hyper-real when I saw her. I thought she was beautiful. Gina Gillen was my aesthetic. Two areas of evidence dominated the search for Sasquatch in the 1960s and 70s. The first, of course, are footprints and the plaster casts made from those footprints. It's hard to think about Sasquatch without picturing in your mind's eye a black and white photo of some guy posing next to an upright plaster cast of a, well, Bigfoot. The second area of evidence is a single artifact. 954 frames of 16mm Kodachrome II, known as the Patterson-Gimlin film. These two areas of evidence drove the search for Sasquatch and seemed to prove beyond a doubt that it existed as a physical animal. That is assuming you bought the evidence. Skeptics believe that all the footprints are fakes, and the Patterson-Gimlin film is a dude in a gorilla suit. Let's set the footprints aside for a moment and just talk about the film. In my opinion, it's the strangest piece of film that has ever existed. I don't think it looks like a dude in a gorilla suit. To be more specific, it does look like a dude, I just don't buy the gorilla suit part. Something about it looks distinctly human, and that's the part that fucks with my brain. If that thing is real, it seems closer to human than any animal I've ever seen. Some people wonder why armed hunters who have encountered Bigfoot haven't simply shot it and dragged it home and solved the mystery forever. The hunters almost always say something along the lines of, "It looked too human." I'm no hunter, but I too would have a hard time firing a gun at whatever is in the Patterson-Gimlin film. Now, on to the top three reasons why I don't think the film is a person in a gorilla suit, and I'll try to make this quick. 1. If you were hoaxing this, the last thing you would do is film a guy in a gorilla suit in full daylight in an open area. You'd film it in a dark forest where there's plenty of foliage, plenty of cover to hide the flaws in the suit. 2. If this was a suit that could be made in 1967, then it's a suit that could have been made in 1968 or 1970 or 75 or 80 and every other of the 58 years between then and now. But it's never been done. Not even close. 3. When the film was made, there was no way to anticipate the level of scrutiny that could and would be brought to bear on it in the ensuing decades. Our ability to stabilize that film and scrutinize every frame of it within an inch of its life should have revealed the trick years ago, if it was a trick. But instead, our increasing technology has not revealed the zipper. It's revealed musculature beneath the fur, something a gorilla suit couldn't show, not then, not now. So, unless some pretty radical proof turns up, I do not believe what I'm looking at in the Patterson-Gimlin film is a person in a gorilla suit. But if it isn't that, then what is it? I don't have a fucking clue. And look, at this point, footprints and films just aren't going to cut it. If the Patterson-Gimlin film was made today, I wouldn't believe it. It's simply too easy to fake nowadays. So, for better or worse, in 2025 and beyond, it's going to have to be a Bigfoot body. And hopefully one that died of natural causes, like being run down by a Silverado. It's hard to make a one-to-one comparison, but I don't think people were more eager to kill a Bigfoot in 1975 than they are now. I think most people interested in tracking Bigfoot would like to establish some kind of physical proof without ever having to actually be the one to pull the trigger. But dead or alive, back in 1975, the people doing the most aggressive organized hunting were rich. They were able to self-finance expeditions to find Bigfoot, and obviously they were also hoping to make a lot of money, or at least earn the reputation for having solved what even then was a near ancient mystery. René de Hinden was not a rich man, but he was somewhat well-known and well-connected when it came to Bigfoot hunting, and he managed to join up with some of the more significant and widely publicized hunts of that era. I'm tempted to go into detail about a few of them, especially because one was headed up by a Texas millionaire and Yale graduate with the irresistible name Tom Slick. But unfortunately, A, none of them found Bigfoot, and B, all of them in retrospect sour a little in terms of what we learn about humanity, much less Sasquatch. What starts out as an idealistic search for a mythical beast always devolves into a sad, tawdry echo of the treasure of the Sierra Madre. Groups of dudes set out, usually extremely under-equipped for some reason, and very quickly the expedition either splits into warring camps or dissolves bit by bit and person by person until nothing is left. In one case, otherwise mature adults spent months chasing not Sasquatch, but a prospector named Joe Metlow, who assured anyone who would listen to him that he had access to a possibly still-living Sasquatch that he had trapped in an abandoned mineshaft. He entertained multiple and repeated offers from a range of hunters, including René de Hinden, for tens of thousands of dollars to disclose where this mineshaft might be. But his story kept changing, and after a while, even the desperate hunters grew frustrated and gave up. No money was made. But enemies? Oh, people made plenty of those. While de Hinden obviously wanted the fame and fortune that would come with being the first person in history to prove the existence of Sasquatch, he struck the people who knew him as an honest man driven by something else, something more personal and pure than just wealth. But what was it then? If it wasn't money, what was driving René de Hinden? One day just before Christmas vacation, Mrs. Valentino dropped me off at home after school, and as soon as I walked in the door, I knew something was wrong. I could always tell. Something about the air was different, Something bad was happening, or about to happen. I walked into the living room to find my mom crying. Grampy, my grandfather, her dad, had had a heart attack early that morning. He was currently in the hospital, stable, but they were running tests. As it turned out, there was a blockage in his aorta, but it wasn't considered immediately life-threatening, so a bypass surgery was scheduled for the first week in January. Instead of putting a damper on things, Christmas that year felt weirdly exciting. Everyone's emotions were torqued up, and by everyone, I mean my mom and her sisters. They were trying so hard to tamp down their own anxiety about the upcoming surgery and not show any sign of worry to Grammy or Grampy that every gathering took on an almost manic energy, which I processed as super fun. On Christmas morning, in what was to become a tradition, I found a paperback book related to a specific interest of mine in my stocking. This first year, the book was Don Hunter and Renee DeHinden's Sasquatch. I was beyond thrilled, and I started reading it immediately. I skipped over all the boring parts, Renee DeHinden's childhood, and the early Native American legends, and went straight to the recent sightings. I wanted to know that this Sasquatch stuff was still going on right now, today, and that if I ever got far enough north, I might see it myself. Rereading the book now, I can see why I loved it so much. Don Hunter's tone is consistently gung-ho. He reports on hoaxes with as much enthusiasm as he does the evidence that appears genuine. And a lot of his reporting on the scientific evaluation of plaster footprints and the Patterson-Gimlin film still hold up 50 years later. What doesn't hold up is his unspoken conviction that the mystery is on the verge of being solved. But of course, I didn't know any better than he did. Like Hunter and DeHinden, I felt like I was on the verge of a great discovery. Something ephemeral that promised to become physical more and more every day. What was Gina Gillen doing on Christmas morning? What presents was she opening? And who was she thinking about when she opened them? It wasn't until the holidays passed and the reality of my grampy's upcoming surgery settled in that things took a turn and my mom's mood descended into a constant, low-throbbing drumbeat of fear and worry. This didn't bother me as much as you might think. It helped a lot that I knew exactly what it was she was worried about, and it had nothing to do with me, and there was nothing I was expected to do to solve it. Still, I was very aware of her emotions on an almost minute-to-minute basis. Grampy came through his operation with flying colors, but the emotions stirred up by the nearness of his death only seemed to intensify for my mom. There was no sigh of relief, only a fatal, grinding grimness that assured her that next time, things wouldn't work out so well. And next time could be any time. My mom had a special phone installed in her bedroom, a dedicated line that was used for just one specific phone number, my grandparents. It was explained to us that this was necessary so that an emergency call from them would never be missed due to the line being busy. It sort of made sense to me. After all, we were a family of one-ringers. Whenever Grammy and Grampy left our house after some gathering, my mom would always say, "Make sure to give me a one-ringer when you get home." This meant call our house and let the phone ring once and then hang up. This was the code that told us they had arrived home safely, but also conveniently avoided the expense of a completed phone call. This new phone line was relatively cheap because it was only to be used for one phone number, which would always be free of charge. All my dad would pay was a consistent monthly usage fee. We weren't allowed to make any other phone calls on that particular phone. But once it was installed, it was in almost constant use. At least twice a day, my mom would talk to her parents, once in the morning and once at night. My mom's anxiety about the health of her parents had skyrocketed. Suddenly, they seemed incredibly vulnerable at all times. It was that year when her obsessive vigilance about my grandparents' health began. And from that day on, until the day they were both dead, it never stopped. It was also then that for me, my mom began to recede. No matter what she was saying or doing, she wasn't really there at all. Her mind was on her parents, always. All her fears about their fragility had the effect of making her fragile. I felt disconnected from her, like she was siloed off, unable to see me or hear me, unable to comfort me or to be comforted. This was all felt rather than known. But what you know in your body is stronger than what you know in your brain. What my body knew was that I was cut off from my mom, and I needed her now more than ever. And so I began to think about Gina in a different way. I pictured us together, just the two of us, connecting emotionally. I began to fantasize about a secret relationship where we talked on the phone all the time and shared our secrets and cared about each other and supported each other unconditionally. Best of all, I imagined seeing her at school and our eyes meeting, and a deep knowing would transfer between us in that glance, and we would secretly acknowledge our connection to one another. We wouldn't speak of it at school or let other people know. It was something just for us. I'd curl up in bed at night in a tight little ball and think about this until I fell asleep. And without knowing that I was praying, I would pray for this to become real, for Gina to become real, and for this deep, aching need to finally be answered. You know what? How about making 2026 the year that changes everything? A lot of you have reached out asking for help with your personal creative projects. So finally, after 30 years in the business, I'm making myself available really to whoever needs help. Maybe you're writing a TV pilot or a movie. Maybe you're trying your hand at memoir. You want to tell the story of your life, kind of like this podcast. Or maybe it's a novel or a short story or a graphic novel. Look, whatever it is, they say endings are hard, but really getting started is even harder. And that's where I come in. Go to richardhaddam.com and click on Richard Haddam's Writer's Room. I can help you with brainstorming sessions. Maybe you're halfway through something and you're stuck. I can read what you've got so far, help you bring it to the finish line. Or I can read a finished script or a story and help you get it into professional shape so you can finally send it out into the world. Go to richardhaddam.com, click on Richard Haddam's Writer's Room, and let's get to work. Mention that you heard about it on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf, and you'll instantly get a 20% discount, okay? Working with me isn't free, it's not even cheap, but it's worth it. Don't wait any longer. Now's the time to make your dreams come true. Get unstuck at Richard Haddam's Writer's Room at richardhaddam.com. And now, back to the show. My stomach ache started in late January. Huge blooming pain would suddenly build inside my stomach. Not gas pains, but like that. And it would cripple me. When the first one hit, I was at school and I was immediately terrified. It felt like something was going to happen. Something embarrassing. Did I have to go to the bathroom? I wasn't sure. But the idea of using any bathroom away from my house was horrifying to me, especially the ones at school. Instead of leaving the classroom, I just waited, hoping it would pass, but it didn't. Was I going to throw up? Please don't let me throw up. Please, not at school. I couldn't move. I couldn't think. Worst of all, I couldn't be me. The person I pretended to be at school was bright and funny and talkative and never visibly vulnerable. But with this terrible stomach ache, I found I was completely unable to maintain this facade. I felt weak and revealed. It was awful. Could other people see all this? Could Gina Gillen? I finally went to my teacher and told her something was wrong. She sent me to the nurse. The nurse saw me and told me to just lie down for a while. But when the pain didn't let up, she called my mom, who came down to pick me up. It wasn't until I was safely in the car with my mom and we were driving away from school that the stomach pain began to fade away. My mom was worried about me, and weirdly, her idea that day was to immediately feed me something, which turned out to be the perfect solution. I sat with her in the living room eating a bowl of Campbell's tomato rice soup and a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and watching a soap opera called The Days of Our Lives. Is this what my mom did while I was at school? I wasn't interested in The Days of Our Lives, but I was so relieved that the stomach ache was gone and that my normal bathroom was nearby if I needed it, that I happily sat there with her and watched the whole thing. I thought about Gina. She was still at school right now, but she wouldn't know that I was gone and at home with my mom, because despite all my prayers, she didn't know me. The second stomach ache happened a week later and was worse than the first. Maybe the pain wasn't, but the fact of it was. Was something really wrong with me? Was I dying? Because it felt like I was dying. I didn't wait as long this time. I just went straight to the nurse and then straight home. And once again, my mom made me a huge lunch and I felt better immediately. By the third stomach ache, my parents took me to my pediatrician, who examined me and could find no reason for me to have stomach aches. But he did find that I had what he called a, quote, severe case of post-nasal drip. He came up with a theory. I was producing so much mucus that it was draining into my stomach and causing my stomach pains. This also explained why eating food made the pain go away. The mucus only caused trouble on an empty stomach. He suggested that the nasal congestion was due to allergies and referred us to an allergist. The allergist was named Dr. Anthony Vanderkeller, and his office was way up on Las Tunas Drive in San Gabriel, next door to the old Bavarian Inn. I was nervous about seeing this guy because I knew deep down that my stomach aches had nothing to do with allergy-induced post-nasal drip. Dr. Vanderkeller turned out to be about 26 years old, and he made being an allergist look like so much fun that for about a week, I considered becoming one. He acted like testing me for allergies was beside the point, and the real reason we were there was for him to crack me up by muttering insults about all the other people working at the clinic as they wandered by just out of earshot. He tested me for allergies by taking a dozen needles and injecting me just under the skin with serums that somehow contained everything from horse saliva to strawberry juice. The idea was to see if my skin reacted to anything. If it did, then that meant I was allergic to that thing. I sat there in the small office, inhaling rubbing alcohol, and wondering if Gina would be impressed if she could see how bravely I faced all those needles. You'll be shocked to hear that it turned out I did have a whole range of mild allergies. And get this, the thing I was allergic to most of all was book mold. I was also allergic to penicillin and wheat bread and the food coloring used in dark colas. Dr. Vanderkeller assured me this didn't mean I couldn't drink dark cola or read old books. What it meant was he would continually, over a course of months, inject those specific serums into my body until I built up a natural immunity to them and the allergic reaction would back off. It's weird. I hated needles, but I always looked forward to those Wednesday appointments. I would be excused from school 20 minutes early, and my mom would drive me to Dr. Vanderkeller's. Then afterwards, for a treat, we would go to the Foster's Freeze at the corner of Valley and San Gabriel Boulevard, where the old Gemco used to be. I'd get French fries and a vanilla shake. Guess I wasn't allergic to any of that stuff. I loved this routine of ours, and apparently the treatments were working because the stomach aches went away. One day, near the very end of my first round of treatments, as we drove home from Foster's Freeze, my mom suddenly asked, "So who's Gina?" I froze. I could feel something starting to happen in my stomach. "A girl at school," I said. "Is she your girlfriend?" I couldn't tell if my mom was mad or not, but there was something in her voice that sounded, I don't know, threatened? I knew I had only a couple of seconds to say it, and if I didn't say it fast, I'd lose my nerve and never say it, so I said it. "I don't think it's okay for you to go through and read my private stuff." There was a silence that lasted half the span of recorded time. And then she said, "I know, I'm sorry." Then she said, "But I'm still your mother." I wasn't sure what that was supposed to mean. But before I knew why I was saying it, I said, "She's not my girlfriend." "Well," my mom said, "then she's missing out." I knew that was supposed to make me feel better, and it kind of did, but it also made me feel weird that we were even having this conversation. "Besides," she said, "you're too young to have a girlfriend right now anyway." "No, I'm not," I thought in a hot blaze of anger. "I'll have a girlfriend anytime I want, sooner than you think, and you'll never know about it because I'll make sure you don't. I can guarantee you that." Nothing more was said. A week later, the first of my allergy treatments ended. But we never went back, and I never saw Dr. Vanderkeller again. Here is what I can tell you about Renee DeHinden's life before Sasquatch. A section of the book I skipped on my first reading when I was a kid because it was boring. He was born illegitimately on August 23, 1930, in Lucerne, Switzerland, and 1 month later, his mother placed him in a Catholic orphanage. According to DeHinden, quote, "People would come and pick me up like a dog from a kennel. I was finally adopted, but in 1939, my foster mother died, and the man, not his foster father, the man, married a younger woman, and neither of them wanted me." Renee was then placed into a boys' institution in Lucerne. His life was school and work and little else. Quote, "People didn't count for anything," he said. "I was five steps lower than a dog." Then one day, out of nowhere, his actual mother turned up and claimed him. She was now married, and Renee had a younger stepbrother and stepsister. But the arrangement didn't work out. And once again, his actual biological mother abandoned him. Before then, he was at least able to imagine that once he and his mother were reunited, all of his terrible feelings of being less than human, of being nothing more than a dog, would all be washed away. But after the second abandonment, no such fantasies were available to him. As far as his mother was concerned, he knew exactly where he stood. Quote, "I went out into the world alone when I was about 15, and compared with everything else I had ever experienced, every hardship I met with was just a joke." Renee was on his own, finally and completely, and searching, always searching for something. Until the day he learned about Sasquatch. And finally, he knew what he was searching for. The thing he needed to find to make himself whole. A thing that on a very real level, he wasn't sure even existed. By the final week of my sixth grade year, I made myself a promise. I would at least say something to Gina Gillen. I wouldn't let the school year end without at least speaking to her. I felt that by speaking to her, and her speaking back to me, we would both become real. I'd seen enough episodes of television to know that whatever I said, it should be a compliment. So I decided that I would compliment her on something she was wearing because clothes were important to girls. I knew I would see her at the end of the day because by then I knew her entire schedule by heart. She would leave Mrs. Liu's class and I would leave Miss Tambara's class at the exact same time, like we did every day. When I saw her that day, I was so scared, I was literally trembling, but I forced myself through the fear. I hovered around the stairs, and as she walked out of the class, I kind of fell into step next to her and managed to say, "Hey, I like your shirt." She looked at me with a kind of surprised reaction and said, "Thanks, Richie." I had no follow-up. I just lived in the sunshine of her actually knowing my name. And then 1 second later, Jessica, who was right next to her, and I'll never know why, came at me hard. "Where'd you get your shirt, the Salvation Army? Because it looks like a dumpster." Before I completely realized that my head had been cut off, I had time to think, "You mean it looks like it came out of a dumpster? The shirt itself doesn't look like a dumpster. That doesn't even make sense." But it didn't matter. Gina was laughing. I was almost positive it was out of discomfort and shock because Jessica's level of contempt was so unbelievably off the charts. What the actual fuck? I didn't even know Jessica. I felt like I'd been kicked in the balls. So I just shrugged and said, "Okay, see you Monday." Which was completely insane because it was the last day of school. I turned back toward Miss Tambara's class and behind me, I heard Jessica say, "Yeah, see you never." 1 month later, on the morning of July 10th, 1978, my family piled into our green wood-paneled Country Squire station wagon and headed to Grammy and Grampy's mobile home park in Glendora to pick them up for our vacation that year. We were driving to Oregon. Grampy had fully recovered from his heart attack and surgery, and my mom was excited to have them both in her direct line of sight for 2 whole weeks. My brother John sat up front between my dad and Grampy. My mom and Grammy sat in the back, and I had my own domain, sort of a dog bed in the far back between the middle seat and the luggage area. I loved it. Whenever anyone wanted a snack, it was my job to root around in the food box and find it and hand it forward. My mom and Grammy were having the time of their lives. They had filled their empty 7-Up cans with white wine and reveled in their secret law-breaking. Cops would drive by and they'd raise their cans and smile. For most of the ride, I was lying back on pillows perpendicular to the road with a stack of books at my side. Most of them were paperback collections of Peanuts cartoons, or Dennis the Menace, or Heathcliff the Cat, or Family Circus. I hadn't graduated to the Mad Magazine books yet. I had also brought my paperback copy of Sasquatch. And I had only one goal on this trip, to visit the Bigfoot Information Center in The Dalles, Oregon. I had made it clear that I really wanted to go, but that didn't mean anything. No promises were made. And I spent a lot of that trip experimenting with the hurt feelings I imagined I would feel when I finally found out it just wasn't going to happen. But on our second to last day in Oregon, my mom finally confirmed we would be spending the night in the Dalles. I was actually going to get to go to the Bigfoot Information Center. This was huge. Up until then, I had only experienced the supernatural within the pages of books. This would be the first time I would encounter some kind of physical expression of belief. Grown-ups had built a building dedicated to the idea that a mystery existed. Hell, that a monster existed and deserved to be taken seriously and studied. I figured the place probably looked like a college campus. I couldn't wait for my parents to see it, to finally see me. I felt so vindicated. But on the morning of our visit, I found out that my mom and Grammy and Grampy weren't going. It would just be my dad and my brother and me. I was surprised at how disappointed I was. We had all been required to do everything else we did on that trip. No one got to opt out of anything. Every museum, bridge, waterfall, fort, hydroelectric dam, salmon hatchery, and extremely old redwood tree, we all had to be there and appreciate it. But now that we were going to see something actually interesting and important, something that might possibly rewrite our understanding of humanity's mist-shrouded origins, apparently a late breakfast and a dip in the motel pool was considered a more appealing option for some people. Whatever. The Bigfoot Information Center turned out not to be a college campus, but rather a trailer sitting in a parking lot behind Spooky's Pizza Parlor. But it was there, and I had found it, and I was going to experience it. Inside the trailer, glass cases held plaster casts of actual Sasquatch footprints. Black and white photos lined the walls, pictures of various researchers, and stills from the Patterson-Gimlin film. It all felt so real. A man with salt and pepper hair, glasses, and what I took for a British accent was there. He was incredibly friendly and chatted with us and answered questions. I didn't know it at the time, but this was Peter Byrne, the owner and operator of the exhibit, as well as the author of 20 books, including the classic Search for Bigfoot, Monster, Myth, or Man. Peter Byrne passed away just 2 years ago, in 2023, at the age of 97, and he has gone down in history as one of the four horsemen of Sasquatchery, along with John Green, Grover Krantz, and of course, René de Hinden. But that day, almost 50 years ago, he spoke confidently and rationally about Bigfoot. It was almost as if there was no mystery at all, and certainly nothing supernatural. It was like he was talking about hunting elephants. I remember feeling a little relieved because I knew on some level my dad was impressed by this man with a British accent and how non-goofy he made the whole thing sound. We left that day with some pamphlets and a copy of Byrne's self-published newsletter, Bigfoot News, which I then subscribed to and received in the mail at my home in Monterey Park for the next 3 years. I felt older when we left the Bigfoot Information Center, like I had just drifted a bit closer to the center of my own life. In fact, I felt like I had that day that David Valentino opened my eyes to Gina Gillen and told me that one day she would be fine. For most of the past year, Gina had just been a fantasy, a concept. But once we had actually spoken, she did become real to me. And I felt weirdly okay about her. She had treated me like a person. It was Jessica that I clearly had a problem with, for reasons that were not clear and, I can tell you right now, never became clear. But Gina, she was just a normal person now. She wasn't an angel or a devil. She was just fine. The book Sasquatch ends with a prophetic quote from René himself. In 1972, he said, quote, "I have my doubts all the time about what I'm doing. I've always had them. It's a lonely place to be. But it's where I have to stay. I know I won't be able to convince the world because it doesn't want to be convinced. I just have to keep on going, and I will, until one of these creatures is collected, dead or alive." His vindication never came. Over the next 30 years, René de Hinden lost everything in his search for Sasquatch. He died on April 18th, 2001. By then, he and his wife had long since divorced, and his two sons aren't even mentioned as survivors in any obituary of his that I could find. He was remembered fondly by his friends in the Bigfoot community as a man who pursued a special dream for the majority of his adult life. But not only did he never prove the existence of Sasquatch, after 48 years of searching, he never even saw one. When something goes missing early, you search for it for the rest of your life. I stared out the car window for hours during that Oregon trip, and like Renee DeHinden, I never caught a glimpse of Bigfoot. While I searched, I thought about my mom and how she existed in my life, like sunlight, sometimes shining down on me in warm waves, sometimes glaring down on me, unbearably harsh, and sometimes turned away completely, mute and unknowable, disappearing from sight below a far horizon, plunging me into a darkness so lonely and remote it was almost too painful to endure. And even then, I knew that it was in this particular darkness that my real search was taking place, and always would. Searching for something that would comfort me. Something real. Something or someone I could believe in. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producers are Tess Feifel, Sailor Franklin, and Harrison Marks. Our sound designer, editor, and engineer is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver. Our website is by Kayla Lord. And our music, as always, is by Nima Kazzaruni. Please join us next time as we visit this city that talks to the dead, Lilydale. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.